Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Three words, people. Three little words. Interest rates. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday today, the 12th of September. Glad, as always, to have you with us, everybody. If in American politics, Social Security is known as the third rail, that is, the thing that cannot be touched, I would submit that today in American economics, that third rail is interest rates. Money in this country has been so cheap for so long that whenever people, and you can read that as the Fed and big bankers, whenever they start talking about rates going up, everybody gets all uptight. Witness the stock market the past couple of days as various members of the Fed have given various speeches suggesting same. What a breath of fresh air it was then to hear the biggest of big bankers, Jamie Dimon, the CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase, say this today.
My own personal view, and she does not call me for advice, by the way, but, you know, 25 basis points is a drop in the bucket. We say to you all, it's 25 basis points, go really slow, don't worry about it. Let's just raise rates.
25 basis points being a quarter of 1% there. So with the Fed meeting next week on interest rates, Marketplace's Sabri Benishore gets us going with this. After all these years of low, low, oh-so-low rates, can the Fed make a move without freaking everybody out? Here's Sabri.
We may not feel it, but in terms of economic policy, we're basically all at a party, and at some point it's going to run out of alcohol.
Language from central bankers in the U.S. has been drifting ever so slightly in the direction of raising interest rates.
Richard DeKayser is corporate economist for Wells Fargo & Company. The Fed has kept rates low to give the economy a buzz, and he says the economy's slowly doing better and at some point won't need so much buzz. The problem is, just like at a party, how do you take away the booze without ruining everything?
That is the big question that they're wrestling with right now.
Brian Whalen is portfolio manager at TCW.
Are borrowers prepared for higher interest rates? In our opinion, many are not. You have these excessively high levels of debt at a period where we may be entering higher rates.
He says a return to normal rates is going to be disruptive no matter what. The dollar will go up, earnings could fall.
They've made their own bed.
But others say it's doable. The Fed just needs to hold everyone's hand a little. Again, Richard DeKayser.
There are no guarantees, but there are some things they can do. So they can clarify their guidance. They can communicate to us more frequently and more clearly as to what conditions would warrant interest rate hikes.
Another thing, says Bob Murphy, professor of econ at Boston College, is to pick the right time.
The Fed doesn't want to be in the situation of last December of moving and then suddenly having to go on hold.
In conclusion, nobody likes it when you close the bar, so call last call and do it loud and clear. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Next week, by the way, 20th and 21st for the Fed on rates. All right, new topic. If you are a farmer and you want your crops to grow, you are probably going to turn to fertilizers to make that happen, right? If you're a fertilizer company and you want to grow, what do? Well, mergers is what you do. Two big Canadian fertilizer companies are doing that. Marketplace's Jed Kim explains what the deal might mean down here, south of the border.
The two companies are Potash Corp and Agrium. By the way, potash is essentially potassium fertilizer. Agrium is a made-up name. Anyway, Chuck Magro would be CEO of the new group. In the investor conference call, he called it an exciting day.
We are combining in a merger of equals to create a world-class integrated global supplier of crop inputs.
Maybe that doesn't sound exciting, but it would create one of the largest crop nutrient companies in the world. The market cap is estimated at $26 billion. Potash is the world's largest fertilizer producer. Agrium has a major retail network. Roger Dahlgren, a professor of agricultural economics at the University of Arizona, says joining means synergy.
You can eliminate the passage of product from one business entity to the other, and by eliminating that passage of product, you can drive down your costs for moving products through the system.
And indeed, the companies say they'll save $500 million a year. but others see it as a loss of competition with negative impacts. Harwood Schaefer is director of the Agricultural Policy Analysis Center.
Ultimately, farmers will pay higher prices for their potash.
Now there's a new wave of agribusiness mergers. Dow and DuPont, China National Chemical and Syngenta, and Bayer's bid for Monsanto. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
Big football doings out here on the West Coast tonight. The newly minted Los Angeles Rams are up in the San Francisco Bay Area, taking on the 49ers. But even before that first snap tonight, the Rams have doubled their market value to almost $3 billion simply by leaving St. Louis and coming out here to L.A. But in an era where you can watch almost any game at almost any time, does location still matter all that much to a team's bottom line? Marketplace's Adam Allington has that story.
Yes, location matters. Maybe not as much as other things, but it matters. Los Angeles is the second largest TV market in the country.
So therefore, there's lots of people, there's lots of eyeballs, and there's lots of fans and potential fans.
Jim Hawk is the author of the forthcoming history of the LA Rams called Hollywood's Team. Factor into the deal, the fact that the Rams have a long history in the area makes the deal even more lucrative.
They were there before the Los Angeles Dodgers. They were the first team to integrate. There are thousands and thousands of fans across Los Angeles in the Southland, but also across the country.
And coming in 2019, a brand new multi-billion dollar stadium, which will create even more revenue.
Tickets, sponsorship, local media rights, food and beverage, retail sale.
Not to mention high-priced luxury boxes. Adam Jones is with PricewaterhouseCoopers Sports Advisory. Even though the NFL shares the revenue from national TV contracts, those contracts are a huge part of the value.
We're projecting media rights to become the largest segment of the sports market in North America, surpassing gate receipts by 2018.
But while moving to a new football-crazy city might be good business for the team, the benefits for the city itself are not so concrete. So says Ted Gehr, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution.
Having a major league team, whether or not it's football or baseball or you name it, does not convey any economic benefits.
Gehr says the tax subsidies given to teams are often greater than what the city gets back in economic development. In Washington, I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
Higher interest rates? What higher interest rates? All fat, dumb, and happy on Wall Street. Today we'll have the details when we do the numbers. True story, I was boarding my flight home Friday from a reporting trip in Rochester, New York. Stories coming in a couple of weeks. And the gate attendant came on the loudspeaker and said, in accordance with FAA guidance, anybody carrying a Samsung Galaxy Note 7 shouldn't turn it on or charge it on the plane or put it in checked baggage either, lest it catch fire. Samsung announced a global recall of the smartphones last week after pictures of the aforementioned fires showed up online. So to find out what is going on with Samsung and how they get from here to there, we got our senior tech correspondent Molly Wood on the phone to make me smart. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kai.
How much trouble is Samsung in? Discuss.
Samsung's in quite a pickle, if only because it's lost $26 billion in value since this whole thing started, and it's in possibly the most competitive smartphone market that has existed ever.
Yeah. Timing literally could not be worse. So what do they do other than, you know, mea culpa's all over the place and we're going to fix this? What's the way through?
Interestingly, Samsung has been dogged with questions of quality kind of forever. You know, people especially who have been following them as an electronics company know this. But I think the way forward is just to keep going, to keep pushing the Note 7 and to keep advertising it. And everybody who's tried it really likes it. I actually feel like there's every reason to think that they could get past this, but this cannot ever happen again.
Yeah, we should say here you had one, right? You had a review copy?
Yeah, I do. In fact, I have it now. I haven't quite sent it back yet, but I did get the note that said, please send it back.
Yeah,
but
don't turn it on. Come on. It's going to catch fire.
I powered it down, right. But I powered it down reluctantly, and that says a lot.
Is there any reason to think this would not happen to some other phone company? I mean, did Samsung just get unlucky with this?
I think Samsung rushed the phone. Yeah. I think they've been really pushing the limits of design and technology, hoping to find an Apple killer. That said, lithium-ion batteries are a dodgy technology. Pretty much any one of them can catch on fire. This has certainly happened before, and yes, could absolutely happen again.
Marketplace's senior tech correspondent Molly Wood on the Samsung Galaxy Note 7 issue. Thanks, Molly.
My pleasure.
Not to be forgotten in all the back and forth of the presidential campaign as we hit the home stretch is this additional challenge for Hillary Clinton. How to win over Bernie Sanders voters so that come election day, they don't just stay home. One tactic is to ask them for money. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams explains how that's going to work.
Hillary Clinton. I first met Kira Willig at the Democratic National Convention back in July. The Bernie Sanders delegate from Miami was sitting primly with the Florida delegation, and her outfit caught my attention.
The Bernie and Hillary delegates are all wearing seersucker today, so I'm wearing a seersucker dress. I have a teddy bear in a seersucker outfit, and I have a hat that is very steel magnolia, sipping mint julep. But I have burnified it.
That's right. She burnified her hat. It was covered in Bernie Sanders stickers and buttons. At that point, we already knew Hillary Clinton had the nomination. Willig said she was willing to vote for Clinton, but that's about it.
I admit, I get an email from her every day asking me for a dollar, and Bernie didn't ask me to give her money. He asked me to vote for her.
Those emails asking for a dollar, they probably aren't really about the dollar.
Well, at this stage of the game, raising money is not one of the most important things that Hillary Clinton has to do.
Michael Heaney is a political sociologist at the University of Michigan. He says at this point in the game, Clinton doesn't really need the money. She needs some of that Bernie or bust enthusiasm to rub off on her. And according to Heaney,
the people who contribute to political candidates almost always show up and vote on election day.
Even if they've only donated a small amount. Bernie Sanders has been trying to get his supporters to turn out for Clinton, doing campaign events for her in New Hampshire.
On every issue, Hillary Clinton is the superior candidate, hands down.
Even Sanders acknowledged after the convention that it was going to be tough getting his diehards to change gears. Here he is on CBS's Face the Nation.
We have over 13 million people who supported my candidacy. And I have no doubt that there are some of those people who will not vote for Hillary Clinton. But I would say that the vast majority of them will come on board Secretary Clinton's campaign.
And many have come on board. Remember that fashionable Miami delegate from the DNC, the one that burnified her hat? It's been a couple of months since the convention, so I checked in with her. Attorney Kira Willig says she and her fellow Sanders supporters are doing what they have to do.
You know, we've reeled back on our anti-Hillary sentiments, but it doesn't mean that we're going to be out in a field office phone banking for her or donating money to her.
Willig says she will vote for Clinton, but
the sense of those of us who were people who contributed to Bernie is she doesn't need our money. She has her sources, and our money is better used for like the down ballot candidates. And so my efforts and my money have gone towards that.
And not to Hillary Clinton. Not an hour of Willig's efforts or a dime of her money. She'll only invest so much in a candidate she didn't want in the first place. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Coming up,
I met this British consultant who was buying me champagne, shoving money in my pocket, and promising to make me a millionaire.
In Myanmar, of all places, if you can believe that. But first, let's do the numbers. Markets rallied after concluding the Fed's not going to raise interest rates. Yet, the Dow Industrial's up 239 points, 1.3%, because they are going up eventually, right? We all know that. 18,325 on the blue chips. The Nasdaq climbed to 85 points, 1.6%, 5211. S&P 500 up 31 points, almost 1.5%, 21.59. American Airlines said passenger traffic in August declined at nearly 3%. United Continental said last week it saw its own August slowdown, and thus American down 0.3%, United up 1.5%. Today, bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.66%, and you, yes, you, are listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. There is, on a lot of college campuses this year, a conversation happening about race. Georgetown and its legacy of slavery, buildings and programs named after racists at places like Yale and Princeton, and at many schools, how to create a more diverse faculty. Nationally, just 4% of full-time college professors are Black, 3% are Hispanic. So when you hear the term underrepresented minority in an academic context, that is part of what people are talking about. Marketplace's Amy Scott has this story of one business that's trying to change that equation by focusing on one of the biggest barriers to faculty diversity, tenure. Here's Amy.
Carrie Ann Rockamore's experience as a college professor was,
quite frankly, just miserable.
She loved teaching, but the tenure process. Imagine, she says, you work for 6 years trying to be a great teacher and serve on every committee and publish important research, all the while worrying, if you ask for help, will that look like weakness? Can you say no to this dinner invitation from a colleague?
And then at the end of that time, a group of people are going to go in a room, close the door,
and vote.
If you have more yeses than noes, you have a job for life. And if you have more noes than yeses, you need to go do something else with your life. Just imagine that. This vote that's completely anonymous and that no one has to explain.
Rockamore survived that vote, got tenure, and went on to teach sociology for 8 years at the University of Illinois, Chicago. But a lot of her colleagues either didn't get tenure or left before they got there.
I felt a huge responsibility to do something, particularly because the people I saw leaving and not getting tenure were often women and faculty of color.
What Rockamore did was start the National Center for Faculty Development and Diversity.
So I have a very simple prospect for you today.
In seminars like this one at the University of Illinois, Rockamore and her staff offer tools to help more women and people of color not just survive the tenure process, but enjoy their lives as professors along the way.
I mean having explosive productivity and having a life. And let me be clear what I mean by having a life, because some people haven't had one in so long.
Now 6 years old, the center has a network of more than 90,000 grad students, postdocs, and faculty members, and it's partnered with 80 colleges from Amherst to Stanford to Virginia Tech that sponsor training for their faculty. Douglas Haynes is vice provost of diversity and inclusion at UC Irvine.
The impact really comes in retention.
Haynes says in the past 2 years, about 35 professors have gone through the 12-week Faculty Success Program, also known as boot camp. The university offers grants to help cover the $3,200 tuition.
It really represents an investment that the institution is making in the individual faculty member.
That investment not only helps people move up in the faculty ranks, Haynes says, it also makes it more likely they'll want to stay. Balancing the workload as a new professor can be tough for anyone, but at predominantly white universities, African-American or Latino professors may face extra challenges.
Oftentimes, students don't take you as seriously as they might take a white male professor.
Edna Viruel Fuentes is an associate professor of Latino-Latina studies at the University of Illinois and did the boot camp before she got tenure. She says students sometimes call her by her first name or act surprised when they learn she's a professor. At the same time, minority students often seek her out as a mentor or bring their personal struggles to her office.
You know, they feel much more comfortable coming to us. So it's a blessing in a way. But at the same time, it just adds, again, a kind of another layer of expectations that other colleagues in other departments may not necessarily have.
Then there's committee work. If you're the only or one of few professors of color, you're in high demand, especially for committees that have anything to do with promoting diversity. Rockamore says all these responsibilities can actually hurt a tenure candidate.
And so if people are spending huge amounts of time on their teaching, if they're spending huge amounts of time on their service, it just leaves very little time for the one activity that matters the most, and that is doing the research and publishing the results.
The boot camps focus on managing those competing demands, how to prioritize research and writing, say no to people in power, cultivate a network of mentors, and this is really important, get enough sleep.
She's like, ultimately, like, your brain is what you're working with.
And so you have to protect your brain and your well-being.
Whitney Robinson is an assistant professor of epidemiology at UNC Chapel Hill. She did Rockamore's boot camp years ago and does an alumni program every semester. She also keeps in regular touch with other alums online.
These are people I have never met in person, but I know when they're frustrated about their chair or the printer's not working or they're really struggling with a revise and resubmit or a paper rejection. And we've made this amazing virtual community.
Robinson is up for tenure next year and feels pretty confident going into a review. Still,
it's a little stressful.
Yeah, because remember, job for life or time to find something else to do. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Myanmar, Burma, still to some, is a top tourist destination in Southeast Asia. Mostly unspoiled nature, lots of ancient temples, and a new democratically elected government. It is also increasingly, though, a business destination. David Bikino's new book is called Greetings from Myanmar. David, thanks for coming on the program.
Thanks for having me.
You've got this great image. You say that the country looks a little bit like a partially built skyscraper in its incompleteness,
sure.
Right?
Yeah, for sure.
Tell me a little bit about that, yeah.
So I think there's a vision in Myanmar. I think there's something that people want to do, and they want to become this huge Asian powerhouse with tourists and money flowing in. But I think there's just so many issues they have to sort through. And a lot of that stems from the fact that this transition happened way too quickly. I read back in January that they started electric tram service in the country's commercial hub, which is called Yangon. And it was this big ceremony. People were really happy. $3 million they spent on it. It was going to be 3 miles, 7 stops. And then 6 months later in June, they took it off. They suspended passengers. They said only 10 people rode it. It was making less than $4 a day. It just wasn't ready for things like that. And yeah. I think you see this a lot in Myanmar.
Well, so the cautionary tale, of course, is China. And China's been doing it for 30 years, and they're still trying to figure it out. Did you talk to people there, Westerners or locals, who said, yeah, you know what? We need to figure this out slowly.
Well, I think that's a really good comparison. And, you know, a lot of the people I spoke to, you know, Greetings from Myanmar is really a series of vignettes about people on the ground. And they were very cautious of China. You know, like a lot of countries around the world, China was coming in and taking timber and taking natural gas and right. giving them a lot of these contracts to build, improve the infrastructure. But they were saying, you know, we want to do it on our own. We want to kind of figure this out on our own. And the influence of China, they're sort of taking away this opportunity for us to start from the ground level mm-hmm. and to build a country the way we want it to look.
You met a guy in a bar, actually, probably a lot of guys in a lot of bars. Patrick was this one who he had some thoughts.
You know, I said this sort of fast transition is ripe for stories. And within 48 hours of landing in Yangon, which is the main commercial hub again, I was in a bar and I met this British consultant who was buying me champagne, shoving money in my pocket and promising to make me a millionaire if I quit my job at Elon and basically worked for him full time.
Wow. But it's funny because this guy, Patrick, the Brit that you meet, says the window is very small for us, by which I mean Westerners probably, right? To
sure.
make a lot of money,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and the window is also small for tourists in some way. You know, there's a very strange article written by a U.S. travel magazine that said, go before everything changes, yeah. go before the place becomes like everywhere else. And it's a strange take saying, go while they're still primitive and frozen in time, because that's what's interesting about it. And I sort of disagree with that. You know, maybe the opportunity is limited business-wise because people are going to go in and establish themselves and, you know, mm-hmm. and get these contracts with government officials. But to say that it's not going to be interesting in 5-10 years really mm-hmm. does a disservice to the natural beauty of the place, the warmth of the people. So I don't love that sort of argument.
It should be said, though, and you say this in the book, I mean, it's still a fractured place with many, many problems.
Many problems. There's tons of ethnic fighting. And so we do want to be careful talking about that. But the people I met on the ground were so optimistic, and they really were. And maybe it was obviously a small sample, but, you know, I spoke to dozens of people still, and they wanted to talk about the future. They wanted to talk about what tourists wanted, what business people, how do I make you happy? They didn't want to talk about their decades of political repression because, you know, they saw an opportunity to move forward, to get money, to help their family. And so they didn't really want to discuss those sorts of things with me. And so I reported basically what I saw.
It's a book called Greetings from Myanmar. It's a Kindle single by Dave Bikino. Dave, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
This final note on the way out today, Donald Trump went on CNBC this morning, and I will insert here, by the way, that he has a standing invitation to be on this program as well. But nonetheless, he was on CNBC talking about a whole lot of things, including the Federal Reserve, Chair Janet Yellen, and interest rates. And he said, among other things, this.
She's keeping them artificially low to get Obama retired. Watch what's going to happen afterwards. It's a very serious problem. And I think it's very political. I think she's very political. And to a certain extent, I think she should be ashamed of herself.
Reasonable people disagree about why Janet Yellen and the Fed haven't raised rates yet. But the idea that American interest rates, and by extension, if you think about it, the entire global economy, the idea that they are being manipulated as some kind of political favor is without any basis in fact. One could say, so I will, that that's a lie. Whiz bang day on Wall Street today. The Dow up 239 points, about 1.33%. The NASDAQ up 85 points, also 1.33% there. S&P 500 up 31 points, almost 1.5%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Robert Garova, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.